Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
You know, if things had worked out just a little bit differently for Chris Sutton, he would have ended up pushing pens and paperclips at Norfolk County Council rather than terrorising defenders in Scotland and England for over a decade. Chris uses the word character a lot, and we explore how his was forged. From an initial rejection by his home club Norwich, although not the club he supported, to his dad's boot camp approach to physical fitness, brutally demanding. Through his experiences as a promising young cricketer, what's that ball fizzing around your head? And a particularly uncompromising youth team coach at Norwich. Do you know what to top somebody is in football terms? Well, you're about to find out. Nothing came easy for Chris, but it made him grow up fast, survive and thrive. First in a prodigious Norwich side under Mike Walker, which earned him a British transferred record switch to Blackburn aged 21, where did he nearly go instead? Well, you'll find out here. Listen up for stories of Sri Lankan cricketer Ravi Pushpakimara and Andy Theodosio's brutal tackles, how to mark Alan Shearer as a centre-half, and why he says you don't want Efinokoko in your five-a-side team. Although, I want to make clear, having played alongside Efinokoko in a five-a-side team, sorry, Chris, I'm just not joining you in that one. This, I believe, is a side of Chris Sutton that not many folk have heard before. Sit back and enjoy. Part of the great joy of the beginning of this big interview is that we're overlooking a football pitch. And Chris Sutton, I don't know if it means the same to you, given that you graced lots of football pitches in your life as a professional sportsman. But for anybody who adores football the way I do, even to see a naked, empty stadium gives you a buzz. And it's got me thinking about, again, how much I'd have liked to have been on that pitch, how much I'd have liked to have had a career like yours. But it's slightly special because this is you're associated with so many different things. This is your hometown club that you're looking back out at. And I presume there's still a nostalgia and a sentiment when you look on this blustery, grey, windy day out into that beautiful green pitch.
There is with the stadium, with the club, more I would say with the area. I wasn't born in Norwich. I was born in Nottingham, but always brought up in Norwich, a little village just outside. And I used to support Nottingham Forest actually in their glory years, Brian Clough, the European Cups. I didn't jump on the bandwagon. I was born in Nottingham. That's why I supported them. But then I used to follow Norwich. And the amazing thing is at Norwich, unlike a lot of cities which I've been to, in my view, is most of the people do support the local club. It's a one club county. It's the only club in the county. Their nearest rivals are Ipswich, which is sort of a fair bit away, 45.
Ooh, I don't know if we're allowed to mention them out loud.
45 miles. And I had a great time here. But the funny thing is, I was released by Norwich when I was sort of 12 years old. I went on a trial, and I never really expected to get taken on the second time because I'd had the rejection. There was a centre of excellence, as they were called then. I went down for a trial for a couple of months. I have to say, I didn't like the rejection at all. And I started to take cricket more seriously. And I used to just play football locally and for my school. but I actually took cricket a little bit more seriously. I'm not saying I was a brilliant cricketer, but I was good when I was younger, and I played for the county, and I played a level up from the county, which was for the Midlands in a festival called the Bunbury Festival.
Oh, yeah, fierce, yeah.
But then I sort of learned extremely quickly that there were other boys there who were far better technically. And, you know, boys like Mal Loy, I think, who played county cricket, Jeremy Snape.
This was your generation?
This was my,
What?
You know, I have to say it was an eye-opener, because even though I was scoring a lot of runs at county level, I could see that technically these boys were a lot better. In short, I couldn't play the short ball, which was, you know, as you go up the levels, people find you out, and you know.
Technically or psychologically, you could.
Technically, I think, you know, through coaching. I mean, sort of the old school coaching was, they were obviously coached differently and better than me, and, you know, far more natural probably. But, you know, I used to be a bit of a front foot dogger.
Okay.
Get on the front.
Not a Chris Tavares, but slightly more adventurous than.
Yeah, and you know, so I'm. You know, you get up to the higher echelons of the level, and this would have been it was an under 15 festival.
Yeah,
and I was sort of found out.
For those who, because you're now fourth on our series, who's spoken passionately about cricket, and I love my cricket. Started with Gary Neville and the death of a great commentator, Richie Beno, and we talked about that and tried to move it towards Gary's own analytical commentary skills. Malik Tissier was a very, very, very talented cricketer, but probably the most talented cricketer we've spoken to so far was Phil Neville, whose stories were, you know, extraordinary about facing a West Indian paceman aged about 12 in a full Lancashire grown-up league with his dad's permission and his mum sort of pushing the door and saying, don't be a softy, go and do it. Yeah. But for those who don't know cricket that well, when you see the short ball, just physically, what does that mean that a bowler's doing towards the batsman on the wicket?
Well, he's bowling a lot shorter, so you know, you play off your front foot or your back foot predominantly. I mean, the best actually when I moved back and finished football, I played a bit of cricket locally, and I had a player who played for Sri Lanka who proed for the club, who came to stay with us. He was called Ravi Pushpakamara, a good Sri Lankan name. I think he played 24 tests. He was a bowler, but he coached my eldest two sons to play, and he always used to say that you know, the best batsmen, you know, they could see the length of the ball instantly. You know, they could see the length, which, you know, was the difference between a top quality batsman and you know, a pretty mediocre one. So that, you know,
because the short ball, it comes in and bounces in and around the old Adam's apple.
And I think that, to be honest, I think people think that cricket, you know, a lot of sort of people who play football and rugby think that cricket is a game for softies. You know, I can tell you from my own experiences that, you know, it certainly isn't. And if a ball's hurtling down you at 80, 90 miles an hour, you don't. You know, if you don't see it, then it's a major problem. So at the top level, these players, their reaction skills, you know, and ability to play the ball late. I mean, it's just, you know, it's astonishing reaction.
And nerve, because you ever lose your nerve in that instance. Okay, absolutely. Your technique can bail you up, but if your nerve goes up at the top level now, and that ball is fizzing around, then you may as well just walk away.
Yeah, and, you know, you talk about a game psychologically, certainly as a batsman in cricket, and you know, people compare all sports, but that is probably, in terms of brutality, you can have bad luck with a decision, you can get caught out brilliantly, you can be in a bad run form. So psychologically, and people talk about psychological elements of all sports, but that's you know, a batsman where you're supposed to score runs, I mean, that's probably the toughest sport position in sports psychology.
It's high noon. It's a mean bowler one-on-one, yeah. Except the batsman doesn't rotate quite as much as you, every over, you know, that a new mean-faced bowler is going to come in and be pinging that thing down at you or try to trick you with spin. But it's pure, when that ball's being delivered, it's real 1v1, not 11, yeah, not an 11-man sport in that, but, when the, on the wicket.
But the biggest thing is you have one chance in bat. Mm. Where at football, you miss an opportunity, you can get another chance.
So,
and that's the difference. And there may be a variety of reasons why, you know, at the top level, and I watch a lot of cricket, at the top level, people get a chance in the test team and they can be in for two tests, four innings, be caught out by a brilliant catch, get a brilliant ball. Someone else can go in and be dropped twice and make 100. You know, the margins at that. And then psychologically, you know, mentally, you've got to be so strong to get through that at the top level.
Then excuse my romanticism. That's a word that I'll unashamedly use, I think, throughout this interview. I always felt growing up watching the Aberdeen side that Sir Alex Ferguson coached, that having seen a regional club do very, very well, knock over Rangers and Celtic, then win in Europe, it did things, if you're a young, impressionable fan, it kind of made you think, you know, you learn through, well, you can do things, you can do extraordinary things in life because look what they've achieved. Was there any infectiousness about watching that Nottingham Forest team? Because, you know, at that age, watching a club, okay, it was a two-club city, but a club relatively similar to Aberdeen, going on and doing what it did. I'm not sure at what age you'd have been devoted to Forest and League Cup and European Cup or not?
I was very young. I was 73, so I'd have been 7, 8. Okay. So, you know, and it's funny, John Robertson and Martin O'Neill, who ended up as you know, my manager, assistant manager at Celtic, were part of that team. So, I mean, you talk about achievements. I mean, people compare them to Leicester City, and I mean, I don't think we'll ever see the likes of Forest again. A small club, well, not a small club, but a club who had come from nowhere as such, and not only won the league, but the European Cup as well. Mm. An incredible achievement.
You used a phrase that you didn't enjoy the rejection at Norwich, but you had this repertoire as the second chance. Was that mostly to do with you or the club or your dad?
All things. I was playing, taking my GCSEs, and I had two elder sisters and an elder brother, and they all went on and took A-levels, and I was a bit of a black sheep in the family in terms of I wasn't a great tryer at school. I was told in uncertain terms that, you know, I you know, wasn't trying hard enough, and the best thing for me to do would be to go out and get a job. And this all coincided in a very short space of time. What happened? I actually went for a job as a clerk of Norfolk County Council.
Gosh.
So where I could have ended up.
Oh, my Lord. there is indeed a God. Well
there
done.
There you go, yeah. And this was a multiple choice exam in
would you like
Richard
A, English League Division 1, or B, push pens and paperclips?
You know, I can't yet. Well, I don't think you're far off. But anyway, somehow I got the job. But in this space of time, what had happened is I was playing for my school in a county cup competition, and I did quite well. Our school team got through to the semi-finals, and there was a local coach who was affiliated with Norwich City, a fellow called Graham Wren, and he came to watch me. I scored a hat-trick in the semi-final. I think that was against Caister, which is near Yarmouth. In the final, we played Yarmouth, and I scored a hat-trick in the final. And then they asked me down for another trial, Norwich did. And I didn't. This was at the end of the season. So it was a very brief trial. And the manager, Dave Stringer, who was the first team manager at the time, had come to watch me subsequently a couple of months earlier, not specifically me, but a group of lads playing at Yarmouth. And again, at that stage, he, you know, thought I wasn't good enough. So they, essentially what happened at the end of the season, within a brief spell, they took a massive chance on me to give me a YTS youth training scheme, £29.50 the first year, £35 the second year. And in those years since I had been rejected, which was, so I'd be 30, 13, 14, 15, 16, my dad, who was, you know, definitely by far the biggest influence on me, in terms of fitness and pushing me, he was very, I wouldn't use the word brutal, but he would, you know, give me a kick up the backside. He was my school teacher. Mm-hmm. He was very hard on me.
It's a dynamic.
If I got praise, it was quite rare. I mean, I remember him refereeing a school game once, and I went down injured, and he would never give me any favours. Never do me any favours. And I think that was part of him being a teacher in front of the other boys as well. You know, even when I was doing well, and you know, I was, you know, one of the best players in the team. Without being big-headed, but I was. But he wouldn't give me praise in front of anybody. And if I went down injured, he'd tell me to get up. But in terms of fitness, and you know, you've seen me play. Never the quickest at all. You know, I was never the fastest at school. I was never the most athletic. You know, far from it. But in terms of those years, the grounding which he gave me in fitness, I think, set me up and was possibly the biggest part of why I got on, I think, and made it. And then also, once I'd got in there at 16, 17, the boys who had made the steps and signed schoolboy forms, 13, 14, 15, who had an affiliation with the club, I can say this, but I felt psychologically that they expected it to be a natural progression. That's what I felt. And I felt when I went down there that I was psychologically, it's easy to say I wanted it more than them, but I was hungry. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want that to pass me by, that opportunity again. And so I had all those things into the mix. We had a youth team coach who putting it mildly, sort of despised in the nicest possible way. I don't know whether that goes. It doesn't.
Putting it mildly in the nicest possible way, sandwiching the word despised.
That's fair. But what I mean, I didn't like him. He was, but subsequently, since I, you know, when I'd progressed and moved on, and now when I've finished my career and, you know, I understood what it was all about, and I didn't. His name was Keith Webb, and I think he used to work in the ticket office at Carrow Road and did well for himself in terms of, you know, going and doing his badges and getting the job. And Norwich had a good record of producing youngsters, and you have to say part of it was down to him. Mm-hmm. But what he taught the boys, and I have to say at that age, you know, like a lot of lads. 16, 17, 18, you know, so I'm saying I didn't like him. There's a good chance that there were a lot of reasons why he didn't like me at that age. But what I think is missing, and this is my opinion from today's game, is, which is an important part, I felt, was earning the right. And I always felt that that was a very good grounding at Norwich. And what I mean by earning the right, things like in pre-season, we all used to train, so the youth team and first team used to train together, youth team reserves, first team used to train together, not like now where they're, you know, you have the first team squad away, you know, partly to do with numbers. There's, you know, it doesn't happen at all clubs, but Premier League clubs.
Definitely.
And so we, you know, he would rollick us if we weren't finishing miles ahead of the first team in cross country, and you know, which, you know, he's very, very, very hard. But just the fact that, you know, you have to earn the right to jog slowly around the lake at the UEA, the University of, you know, they've done it. And so he was hard. He pushed me. I mean, he topped me once badly, which was, you know, another reason why I didn't like him. He used to train with us, Keith, and he gave us a nasty injury.
Topping me and coming through over the ball.
Yeah, and I had a bad. I was out for a while with it. But looking back, I can understand it because, you know, I was quite chippy myself, and I think I'd have topped me at that age.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Wait. So in other words, with all due retrospect, and with you being objective about yourself and quite kind about a coach who's gone over the top to do a YTS player, which is not great practice. He did it deliberately in that case. Is the
production, I thought he did.
Saying. Yeah.
And yeah, look, I think that I'd come from nowhere essentially because I hadn't come up through the system, and then in a short space of time, when I first went into the training ground, which isn't there anymore at Trouse, that was the old training ground, it went in an environment, and there weren't a lot of local boys. There were boys like the Swindon chairman now, Lee Power. There was Stephen Rocastle, who was David Rocastle's younger brother. These were boys from London who were streetwise, who were smart, and you know, you had to learn. I went to a local school in Norwich, and it can be quite a harsh environment, and you know, there are pecking orders. You start off at the bottom, and you have to handle yourself in that environment. You know, whether you're an introvert or an extrovert, you have to find a way of handling yourself.
Totally agree.
In the dressing room, and I think the main thing is you gain respect on the pitch, which is a big part of it. But you know, in the end, whichever way you want to look at it, we're in an environment where we'd play together at weekends in the local South East Counties League, but we're all competing against each other as well.
Because to get team place or to get up?
To get up the ladder and get contracts. So while on the outside everybody's thinking we're all great teammates and it's all smiles, this, that and the other, I mean, the reality is once you get into this, you know, the second year, you're all trying to cut each other's throat. And you know, that's, you're fighting for contracts. And then in terms of, you know, I spoke earlier about the sort of everything, my base fitness when I went back in. And I wasn't sure how that was going to go, but I progressed quite quickly. I played, I went as a centre forward, but they also realised I could play centre half. I could, you know, read the game quite well. But I just thought I left a lot of the other boys behind. I thought a lot of the boys who had come through the system were dead wood in my mind, and they didn't have the hunger, because I think that was as much a system fault as anything, and I still think it's a system fault in terms of, and there's no other way of doing it, in terms of boys starting young, and you know, you're talking about 12, 13 teenage boys who wouldn't think that's a natural progression.
No, but that must be dinned out of them by not only words and ethos at a club, but by demonstrations that players will be cut, that you won't, that it isn't an automatic staircase. And it's the same as, I mean, in a mini form, it's the same as Alex Hleb now says, what was evident to all of us at watching Barcelona and around the club at the time, that arriving was good enough for him. And at the time, he'd have rejected it. Now he says it's exactly what happens. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's a very expensive player, a very big club. But that thing of, I'm here, is the same as your 12, 13-year-olds thinking, this escalator just keeps on going up, and all I've really got to do is, you know, tread water, and it'll take me up.
Yeah, I understand that. But, you know, as you get older, you know, you're talking about young minds. Mm-hmm. I think, and young, immature minds who just think it's going to happen, and I understand that, and I may have been the same. So, I actually think the best thing which ever happened to me was getting booted out. That's my opinion, and it's very individual. And you know, you could reel off to me quite easily numerous boys who have started off at young ages and gone all the way through the system. But, you know, some boys are far more naturally talented than others.
Also, others who've been rejected and it's broken them.
Yeah.
But the rejection, particularly of, I mean, I'm older than both of you, but if we're talking about this generation that we're either you played in or that we're talking about or that we admired, rejection was something that was, I think, probably far more common, far less catered for, and you had to fight. And it made a lot of people, so many people in your shoes who've won trophies like you did, were rejected. And it seems, I think to those who only listen to this or read the papers or pay the money to go through the turnstile, I think they find it unbelievable to see the finished product. A winner, elite, probably wealthy, fit, certainly looking confident, and to find that they've been rejected once, maybe twice. I think most people find that odd, whereas we know it's just about commonplace.
I think it is. You know, go back to natural talent. How many players I played with who were... I'd say Larson. I'd say Larson, but Larson had to fight, though. He went to Holland and played at a...
Played out of position, fired, yeah, went to the tribunals, risked everything.
But in terms of being a natural athlete, you know, he was... You know, he's a lovely specimen, but I thought he was a natural athlete where, you know, we'd all have to go away on the family holidays and I'd be away running, you know, keeping myself fit. He could go away all summer and sit on the beach and still come back and beat everybody.
I understand. I understand. Really.
And that's, yeah. So, you know, those years and those base years in terms of genetically what I had, you know, I'm a tall mm-hmm. guy, but in terms of, you know, people talk about pace and running ability, I was never a great athlete, but, you know.
Are we touching on your dad, Mike?
Yeah.
Are we touching on what Mike did for you then?
Well,
because
I think so. I think that's the
It was demanding as well. I was listening recently to a Victoria Pendleton story about how early teens she'd go out cycling with her dad of a Sunday night, and in the last 50 miles he would just pull away and leave her and she had to keep up or get lost. Now, it wasn't quite like that with you, but there is, if I understand it correctly, in these things that he did for you in the interim between being rejected and then taken on, it was demanding.
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure without him pushing me as he did, and you know, they're pushing me very hard at times, but... you know, there are people who say that is the wrong way to go about it. But, I don't think so. And I'd say, you know, I've criticised the youth team manager at Norwich. But I think, you know, looking back, had he not been that way and got you to be hungry and earn the right, Mike Walker, who was arguably Norwich's successful manager mm-hmm. going into the reserves, you know, it was an era where you could tackle however you liked. We had a player in the reserves called Andy Theodosio, who's a lunatic. When I say a lunatic, the way he tackled, I think he broke a couple of players' legs. And to be honest, we all used to look up to him. And we sort of wanted to be ferocious. And, you know, training was hostile. And, you know, I'm not saying that. Certainly am I not saying...
My era, you're telling me things that I like, but then, and we won't do it now, but... That's what I grew up watching.
Yeah.
That's how I understood all competitive sport. But I also see wonderful players now whose careers have been elongated and there is a degree to which we're watching a different product. That's a different argument for later. But in case you saw my face, Horace, not fully understand that.
Yeah.
I grew up at Pittodrie where if somebody had a little dig at Strachan or Weir, you set your watch for Willie Miller. And I don't know if it's
Andy Theodosio, his name.
Theodosio. Well, he wasn't a lunatic, but he could Theodosio anybody just to make sure that they didn't touch his teammates again. And we paid to see that. Mm. And I thought it was right.
Yeah. And it was a top or get top, really, wasn't it? And that was the sort of... that was the environment. Mike Walker was a straight talker, was a goalkeeper, came to Norwich Norwich City as a reserve manager. And again, just, you know, the basic, earn the right, you know, push on. People talk about analytical, the analytical side of the game. But they were, you know, and I understand that, but, you know, the mentality back then was, you know, blood and guts, you know, a lot of it. And then I thought Norwich was a really good club to be brought up at in terms of people talk about the West Ham way, not necessarily the Norwich way, but people locally would. And Norwich used to produce a lot of boys. We used to do a lot of keep balls in training.
Oh, yeah?
And then if you were doing well in the youth team, there was a space in the reserve, purely because of squad size.
Mm-hmm.
Doing one in the reserves, you were the next one into the first team. And that's essentially how I got into the first team.
Now, I don't know if you can remember or not, and I also haven't completely sure whether I've got my facts right. But once you break into the Norwich team, is that your first experience of Alan Shearer in February 1992?
And what game would that have been? Norwich against Southampton?
All I would say is that Norwich beat Southampton, and a little birdie tells me, I'm sure accurately, there's a good chance you did play centre-half in that game, whether it was auxiliary or whatever. Clearly your talent at centre-half was something that, particularly, I love the phrase where you said, I could read the game. That's beautiful for centre-half, because that's what we maybe sometimes would have called a sweeper. But in February 1992, one of the guys who'd have an impact in your life, your career, what you won, I think you...
I did. I can remember playing against Alan. It was here, and I hope I've got my facts right. But
It was.
It was a Carrow Road. And all I can remember about Alan, a little thing sticking in your mind, is how strong he was.
Hmm.
Literally how strong he was, you know, when people back in and, you know, defenders, you're trying to be aggressive and thinking he's like a wall. And he you know, Alan isn't someone you look at who, you know, is full of big muscles bulging, but he was a powerhouse. He wasn't, at that stage... in terms of goals, he wasn't a goal machine, but he was a powerful runner, you know, as well. He used to run the channels, but I remember him just for that reason and thinking, blimey, in terms of his physical strength, I think, you know, he's a handful. But then it was subsequently when he left Southampton, I think he scored goals at Southampton.
Yes.
But not nearly as prolific. No.
Maybe that's age, maybe that's environment. But when you prepare for a game, not in that specific game, around that era, you're playing out of position, if I can say inverted commas, because even though you're talented there...
A lot of your... Norwich fans thought that.
I wasn't speaking euphemistically, I promise you, Chris. You don't get video preparation for a match like that, I guess. You probably didn't have much idea how Shearer played. He wouldn't have run on the TV a lot.
I didn't know who
Alan
was.
That's my point.
And he wasn't a household name. But then it's like you learn and you learn on the job and you pick things up. And so what I picked up from that day is, you know, don't get too tied to him. You know, just that strength thing stuck in my head that day. Did I think Alan would go on to have the career at that stage? No, but of course I didn't, because he wasn't a household name.
No,
you'd know players who you'd come up against, but because Alan was at Southampton, Southampton weren't
on the box less regularly. No. It was less that he wasn't known than. I really like the idea of, albeit you're talented at centre-back, you don't play there all the time, you've got a very talented young player in front of you, you don't know what he's going to do. That idea of playing, learning as you go and winning the game, I like that. So different from now, when players are probably saturated with detail about do this, don't do that. They know the players inside out, because even if the coach doesn't prepare them with it, they can choose to watch any player they want in the world over and over again if they want to.
Yeah.
Whereas you come into it cold and you have to, like you said, learn on the job.
But I think that there's a... learning on the job is better than watching on the television. And the reason I say that is because Well, when I say that, I mean at the top level,
yeah.
Elite level, mm-hmm. because the best players, the top players aren't, I don't care what anybody says, the top players aren't readable. Mm. If you watch players at the lower level and someone's predominantly left-footed and always drives on the inside, always goes to his left, then I would say that's readable. But at the top level, people set you up. You know, they'll drive the outside a couple of times and they'll think he's gone the outside and have the ability to go on the inside. So that's, you know, learning on the job is, you know, it is better. So the first time I played against Alan Shearer at centre-half, the one thing I think is don't get too tight because he will mm-hmm. murder you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the difficulty is at the top level, Ian Wright used to rip me to pieces. I thought he was a, you know, he's a brilliant centre forward, you know, and I see him, I tell him that, you know, he was a real all-rounder, and I used to have a nightmare playing against him.
Well, for an odd situation to be about to argue with the person who knows exactly what happened, but we'll come back to that one later, because I think there's a moment in the title race where that's not exactly how it plays out. However,
I did well. That was in the title race at Norwich. It was a different kind of fish.
Okay, fair point well made. So the next experience of Alan Shearer, but not just him, is our first big experience of Blackburn Rovers. Now that doesn't go so well. 7-1.
Yep. I remember that game. Well, we finished third that season and we had a negative goal difference. We did.
Thanks to this.
That's why Mike Walker moved me up front the following season. Well, it wasn't. But the 7-1 game was at Ewood. And my centre-half partner was Ian Butterworth.
Yeah.
And I learned a lesson that day. It's a good lesson, actually. We got beat 7-1. I didn't cover myself in glory, but neither did Ian Butterworth. And I think Ian Butterworth came back and did the local press and said that I told Chris Sutton to keep his head up after the game. And I thought, all right. That was a... you know, that was quite intelligent from him.
Cold blood, I would say.
No, I thought, all right, yeah.
There are murder mystery weekends based on less than that.
I'm all right.
Whoa.
So, you know, and all these things. I mean, it's all joking.
I still can't believe you've got a smile on your face about that one. Yeah. I'd still be looking for him.
Yeah, well, and you know, that's is... All these things, when you're young, they're on the pitch, off the pitch. It's a learning curve, isn't it? And you know, what does that teach you to do it? I think, you know, certainly my younger years at Norwich and watching and learning and, you know, looking up to people. Certainly my younger years. I think my time at Norwich, what evolved was. I understood the mentality. I think I learned the mentality and, you know, in terms of not really suffering fools by the time I'd left Norwich. And I could, you know, little things like the Butterworth thing where I could handle myself.
What is that, handle myself and not suffering fools, mean? I don't think it means topping somebody in this instance.
No, I think handle...
Does it mean face-to-face having it out?
Yeah, and standing your ground... But also, and you know, when I had a bad game or things went wrong, I wouldn't argue my corner if I was doing badly, and you know, I would take it, and then if I thought the manager was wrong in his criticism, I would say. But, you know, those things didn't often overlap because normally the manager was right. So, you know, I was very honest about my... very objective about my own performance. Very objective.
So, Norwich is a glorious time. You finished third. The European run is brilliant, but...
No pressure.
Respect, it's not the...
No pressure. And, well, there wasn't any pressure because...
Because you seem to be punching above your weight as a club.
And Norwich play Manchester United, who expects Norwich to win? Norwich play Liverpool, who expects...
We pumped Liverpool.
Yep.
Pumped Liverpool 3-0.
Yep.
Beat Bayern Munich.
Yep. And, well, I mean, and you can imagine, I mean, there's, you know, probably the best era Norwich have had. You know, people talk Arsenal losing in the week to Bayern Munich and, You know, I think Norwich were one of the only teams to beat Bayern Munich, certainly in the Olympic Stadium.
Yeah.
And we had a good team. Mm-hmm. I mean, we did have a good team, and I was very lucky. And when I say I was lucky that we had players in the team who, that season, 94-95, I scored 25 league goals, and that was really my breakthrough season. That was 93-94, sorry. Mm. No, I got that wrong. 94-95 was Blackburn. Mm. But that 93-94 set me up the season, and I played with a player called Ian Crook, mm-hmm. and who used to have a little routine with free kicks, and I used to score, but he used to be so perfect with his delivery. Essentially, that was him who's, you know, making the goals, where he'd put the ball down, he'd look up, I'd make a movement, he'd put it in, and I'd scored a few goals that season like that. And really, you know, I was lucky to, because had he not been able to execute that pass so perfectly, I had a good relationship with Rule Fox.
Rule Fox, obviously a big impact. Yeah.
Had a really good understanding. Centre forward play. People talk about, you know, just playing the single centre forward. We always used to work in partnerships, and I always felt I was always far more effective in a partnership with a certain type of player. And I used to, I think, you know, look, if I look all the way back through my career, I was a focal point, really. And I could always play well with people around me. I had, you know, good awareness of who was around me and link up play.
So the first ball would maybe be aimed at you generally, whether it was feet or chest or head. The focal point I'm trying to broaden out as a...
But it was used to work well off another centre. I mean, different types. So I could go back to my, you know, I first went into the team with Robert Fleck. I didn't play a lot of games with him. A player I used to like playing with, or we used to be very effective, was Efnikuku. Mm-hmm. Efnikuku, if you watched him in a five-a-side, you'd think it'd probably, he'd won a raffle to come and train with you. You know, he was that bad. But give him space to run into. For me, he was perfect. Because you didn't have to be exact. You'd flick balls on, hook balls on. He scored four goals at Goodison. I mean, and, you know, he's actually a good finisher. Effen was. But, you know, he suited me. He wasn't a clever player.
We had him playing, you know, sort of end of season Sky, five-a-side, not that long ago. And he looked very good at our level, I have to say.
There you go.
You've topped us there. That was a good one.
So I was going about the youth team coach in Norwich, but in the youth team you were taught to play partnerships, get in line, little overs and, you know, dummies and play round corners and things. I thought that was, you know, a great way to be brought up. And, you know, it's an art. Certainly twin striker play is an art, because teams play differently now, which is dying. Mm. Really, when you look back at the Premier League in the mid 90s and the late 90s, wherever you look, there were partnerships, and it didn't have to be big man, little man. But you look at Klinsmann and Sheringham. I mean, later on York and Cole. I mean, sensational. You know, a lot of their movements, getting in line, clever footballers, little overs. I remember the goal in Juventus. They were brilliant.
You're also talking about, I know you mean more than those four. You talked about four very good footballers individually also. It wasn't simply the partnership. These are elite footballers. I grew up watching Keegan and Toshack. That was the first partnership that really made an impact on me.
Yeah.
And, you know, they weren't very similar people. I'm not even sure they'd gone. In fact, they weren't that close.
Yeah.
But as far as partnership, they were little and large, but they were dynamic. They were extraordinary as a partnership. I'm not quite sure why it would be that type of pairing isn't predominant anymore. Don't really understand
It's the way teams play, though, isn't it? Teams don't play...
two up?
They don't play two up now, do they? They'll play with a... You describe three up, and they'll get the wide men coming in off the, you know, trying to make those little runs in between centre half and full back. I play with a number 10. We know what a number 10 is. Sort of back in the day, I mean, this is rocket science, isn't it? But so you used to play with two up, but what's the difference between a 4-5-1 and a 4-4-2? 10 yards, essentially. And I was always taught that, especially when I was at Blackburn with Alan, that one of us had to drop into the, to make it a holding midfield player. And, predominantly that was me. So out of possession, you know, that hasn't changed. When people talk about systems, it was never 4-4-2 really defensively.
No, that makes total sense. But I mean, I don't want to go down to Bannermeana because I want to get to the title winning season. But
yeah.
it's catnip to me. When you hear people talking about systems, they'll say, just like you've swept aside the way in which people talk about them in terms of how you play. I read people in England for ages saying, well, 4-4-2 is hopeless. Nobody plays 4-4-2 now. It's so, it's an anachronism. That's rubbish. No system can be outdated forever. What do you teach your players to play? What types of footballers do you have? What brand of football do you want to do?
Totally agree.
What do they do with and without the ball? Don't ever say some sort of structural system is. That's absolute ridiculous nonsense.
I think it is. And... you can shoot me down. You watch a lot of sort of Spanish football and know that the game inside out. But for me, sort of a lot of people's failings in recent years is, they try and play like Barcelona, but they don't have the players. Yeah. And that's essentially it. And, you have to use which tools you have. At Norwich, at that particular time, when we won in Bayern Munich, we played with three centre-halves and a sweeper and had two wing-backs. But what we had, because we were conceding a lot of goals, so you think about that. But what we had is we had players who could get us up the pitch, Rule Fox in the right wing position. And then when Efanikuku played, we had space in behind was his strength. So it actually suited us beautifully. The first game we won that season against Vitus Arnhem away, we won 3-0 here. And we'd gone away and we drew 0-0. He missed four sitters. Mm. But he was such an unbelievable outlet for you. It's a weapon. So Mike Walker, got a lot of stick at Everton, but at Norwich, he was quite shrewd, conceding too many goals. Well, it was a case of numbers.
Yeah.
Numbers make it difficult. And there's our weapon. They'd use me as a focal point. And
in defence, you could have five in the back with two in front if you really wanted to close something off.
Yep.
If you had three centre-backs, plus a sweeper, plus two wing-backs, if you drop that, plus four, that's six at the back, plus two.
you had Ian Crook, who was, very, very creative, couldn't run, couldn't tackle, but so creative, on the ball in... wonderful, wonderful vision. Jeremy Goss, the hero, of Bayern Munich. He had legs. So we talk about systems, but we had a good balance in terms of personnel. We didn't have a great team of all round players who were capable of doing everything. Far from it. But we played well to our strengths and. Going into the title winning season, Blackburn, we weren't a free flowing, on the eye, sparkling play teams off the park football team. Far from it.
Now, this is the part where you find out that some of my outro is written for me because I have to thank Hugh the Mamba McDonald. Now, Shug, Hugh McDonald, the Mamba? No, I don't know either. But thanks to the Mamba for helping to organise this interview and Richard Winton for aiding all of us in our research. The big interview is produced by Backpage and me, Graham Hunter. The music that you always listen to, beautiful stuff it is too, is by the talented Beer Jacket. Check out his music on iTunes or on Bandcamp. You can keep up with everything that we do, enter exclusive competitions and put your questions to our future guests by joining the mailing list at grahamhunter.tv.
That site is also where you can buy the new updated version of my book, Barca, The Making of the Greatest Team in the World. My story of the Pep Guardiola era at the Camp Nou between 2008 and 2012. It is in all good bookshops now, but it does make a big difference to all of us who worked on the project and who work on the big interview if you do buy direct at grahamhunter.tv/books. You'll be sure to get the new edition and you'll be helping us to continue producing independent content. This content is still for free. Thanks for listening. We do this for you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.